Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tragic image of a Turkish police officer cradling the lifeless body of a three-year-old Syrian Kurdish boy found washed ashore after the rickety boat carrying his family to Greece capsized, drowning his five-year-old brother and mother as well. Jenna Mason, the senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the U.S. government, joins us. We'll discuss how Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan have taken in over 4 million Syrian refugees so far, but insufficient funding of the UNHCR by donor nations, particularly in Europe, has led to shortfalls in caring for the continuing outflow of Syrians fleeing the civil war, leading refugees to risk their lives in the hands of callous human traffickers as they cross the Mediterranean in unseaworthy boats to Europe. Then we'll speak with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. She joins us to discuss efforts today in Brussels at an emergency meeting of European leaders to deal with the growing crisis, where Hungary's right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orbán warned that Europe's Christian future is at stake, as he blamed Germany for creating the migration crisis by offering asylum to refugees. Then finally, we'll examine the sentencing today of a county clerk in Kentucky who, acting on God's authority, has defied the Supreme Court by continuing to refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Carl Tobias, the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond, who has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country, joins us to discuss whether jailing Rowan County's Kim Davis instead of fining her will make her a Christian martyr soon to appear at a megachurch near you. And joining us now is Jenna Mason, who's a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the U.S. government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jenna Mason.
Thank you very much.
And a U.N. inquiry into the Syrian civil war has criticized a global failure to protect Syria's refugees, saying it's also fueled Europe's migrant crisis. And the Commission of Inquiry on Syria was established by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate violations of international human rights law. And I guess it raises the question of who's to blame in this collective failure?
Well, it's a good question. I'd like to start by saying it's not something that's unmanageable in terms of the refugees who are fleeing. Obviously, what's happening in Syria is without a doubt a crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis, a human rights crisis. People have been killed. People have been displaced. Clearly, what's happening in Syria, the violence, the persecution, is a crisis. And obviously, we have huge numbers of individuals displaced within their own country. About over 7.5 million Syrians are uprooted from their homes in their own country. Many of them are in hard-to-reach areas, besieged areas. Some of them are living without food, without any sort of protection. Another 4 million have fled Syria and are in neighboring countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and elsewhere. Because those countries have borne the brunt of the crisis in terms of the refugee outflow, many individuals are now, as you noted, fleeing to Europe and other places where they hope they can have a little bit of a better life than what they're experiencing in the region. This is something that is just the nature of refugee outflows. What's happening in Europe right now, however, is largely due to the fact that Europe's own asylum system, the way it was harmonized years ago, is not quite capable of addressing the large numbers of people that are coming in now and the way they're coming in. As you know, Europe has open borders within the EU, and the way the harmonized asylum system works is that wherever an individual first sets foot in the EU is supposed to be the place where they lodge their asylum claim, and that's supposed to be the country that determines their asylum claim. But because the numbers are so large and because the asylum systems in those frontline European states aren't quite up to the task, and because there's such disparate treatment in terms of approval rates and reception conditions among European countries, many individuals are choosing not to stay there, and some of those countries are choosing knowingly to let them go. And some of the other European countries are saying, wait a minute, this isn't our responsibility, we don't want these individuals. So really the European countries need to get together and work out a plan to equitably share responsibility for these individuals. Again, we're talking tens of thousands compared with 4 million in Syria's neighboring countries. So the numbers are not unmanageable. They just need a plan to equitably share it. And I would say a lot of observers are saying this is really a European crisis. Europe needs to handle it. Yes, Europe does have collective responsibility, but it's a global responsibility to address the results of the Syrian crisis. Even though European countries are receiving these asylum seekers across the Mediterranean and across borders, you know, countries like the U.S. and many other countries need to continue being donors to not only to my organization, UNHCR, but to other agencies that are assisting the Syrian refugees in the region. The other countries also need to exert diplomatic leadership to hopefully end the Syrian crisis, because that's the only thing that ultimately is going to address this whole situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Janna Mason, who's a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the U.S. government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. And Jenny, you mentioned how the Europeans, in fact, I can quote from this UN report from the Commission on Inquiry into Syria, quoting, "The global failure to protect Syrian refugees is now translating into a crisis in southern Europe. The responsibility for the protection of the human rights of these refugees is not being adequately shared or shouldered." Now, the European leaders or their representatives met today in Brussels, and they simply didn't come to an agreement, with Hungary being very much the outlier. So this raises the question, given that you mentioned there are over 4 million refugees in the very neighborhood of Syria, Turkey has taken in about 2 million, Lebanon 1.1 million, Jordan 630,000, Iraq 250,000, Egypt 132,000, and North Africa about 25,000. Those are the figures that we have.
Those are correct, absolutely.
So wouldn't it behoove everybody to basically take care of these people that are in place rather than force them to go on these hazardous journeys across the Mediterranean where many die? And of course, the whole world is riveted by the picture of the body of the young 3-year-old Syrian boy being picked up on a Turkish beach.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just talk a little bit about what we have been doing for the past the crisis is in its fifth year now. So for the past several years, for the Syrian refugees in the region, UNHCR, other UN agencies, non-governmental organizations, all of our partners, and the governments in the region collectively have been protecting and assisting what is now the total that you gave, over 4 million refugees. Since the beginning of the refugee outflow, UNHCR has spent, I think, over $5.5 billion on protecting, caring for these individuals, but that's less than half of the funding that we've actually needed. For 2015, the humanitarian agencies and the governments in the region have collectively appealed for $5.5 billion. And we've about $4.5 billion of that is for humanitarian agencies. Another billion is for the governments in the region. Like you said, Turkey and others have absorbed a lot of the costs of helping the refugees. So $1 billion is to assist governments. And collectively, I think that appeal is something like 37% funded. So that's a 63% funding gap. So there's a lot of effort being done in the region. If you travel there, I've been to Jordan twice, I've been to Lebanon twice. If you travel to the region, you'll see a tremendous amount that's being done and has been done for these refugees. There are some big refugee camps in Jordan, one that's very well known, Zatri Camp. A lot of the media has traveled there. Turkey has a large number of camps along the border region. Lebanon doesn't have camps, so the refugees are spread out in something like 1,300 locations throughout Lebanon, and in fact, you gave the number about almost 1.2 million refugees. 25% of the population in Lebanon now is a Syrian refugee. So that country is doing a tremendous amount and feeling a tremendous strain. Something like 80-85% of the refugees throughout the region are not in camps. They're in urban areas. Now, urban could be Amman or Beirut, or it could mean a small village, but they're not in camps. They're either renting apartments, and many are running out of money to do that. Some of them are in collective centers, unused sports facilities and schools. Some of them are living out in plastic sheeting or under billboards. I mean, it's a desperate situation for a lot of the non-camp refugees. But we're providing a tremendous amount of assistance. And again, every time I say we, it's not just UNHCR, it's our partners. We've been feeding, providing shelter, providing cash assistance to the refugees. The World Food Program has been providing a lot of food. And again, these host communities are spending a lot of their own money in providing for the needs. So it's not that plenty isn't being done. It's just that the funding has fallen woefully short, and that's why the situation is getting increasingly dire.
So given the picture that you've just given us, Jenna Mason, where I think basically there's about a two-thirds deficit here, we know that Turkey spent about $5 billion, and they are simply running out, and that obviously has contributed to the outflow. And if the Europeans are finding themselves being burdened, why, and in particular countries like Hungary, basically want to put a wall and stop this? If that is the attitude, and Angela Merkel has basically castigated some of her European colleagues for not being particularly charitable and forcing the Spanish to step up a little bit, and the British as well, my sense is that if the Europeans are being resistant to dealing with this humanitarian crisis, why then wouldn't they be more receptive to spending money at the source, where you've just pointed out there's a two-thirds deficit in what is being raised compared to what is needed?
Yeah, hopefully now governments will see that funding is better spent in the region rather than, as you said, have people risk their lives or put themselves in the hands of smugglers. Some individuals will always choose to try to get to Europe or try to get to other countries. Some of them do have relatives in these countries. And if you're forced from your home and you're living in limbo and you have family or close friends or community somewhere, I think it's just human nature to try to get to where you have a support network. So some individuals will always choose to try to move on and get to another location. So we don't want to cut off that option completely. You know, you talked about building walls, which is sometimes a response of governments to immigration, migration flows. It may be a questionable response, whether it works, but it is the response that some, you know, tighter border controls is sometimes a response of governments to immigration. But again, there's a difference between a migrant and a refugee. A migrant is somebody, or an economic migrant, who voluntarily chooses to move to another country, usually for economic opportunities. A refugee, or an asylum seeker, if you don't yet know if they're a refugee, is someone like a person fleeing Syria who's forced to flee because of war, violence, persecution. And these people are exempt from normal migration controls. Countries do have the right to determine who enters their country. But all the countries you're talking about in Europe and the U.S. and most industrialized countries are parties to the 1951 Refugee Convention, which says you can't send back a refugee or someone who could be a refugee to the country where they flee, where they fear persecution. So building a wall is never, and just turning people back without considering their claim is never an appropriate response to asylum seekers. And again, with what we're seeing in across the Mediterranean and in Europe, it's largely people fleeing Syria. Others are fleeing Afghanistan, Eritrea, other countries that are producing refugees. For the smaller percentage of people who are coming from countries where they're just fleeing, you know, economic poverty, you know, obviously we would like a humane response to them. But if they're not a legitimate refugee, then they are subject to normal deportation. But getting back to Europe, so first of all, we would hope that they would not erect walls or have any policies that would not allow people to seek asylum, particularly from Syria and countries like that. And yes, we were also saying that part of a holistic response would be allowing people to move if they have family, close friends, maybe making labor market opportunities available to some of these people so that they have legal, safe and legal avenues to move to some of these countries rather than undertaking risky journeys. But ultimately, like you said, the vast majority are going to stay in the region bordering Syria. Most of them don't have the money or the resources either to pay a smuggler or on their own to try to get to Europe or elsewhere. So they're going to stay in the region. And yes, economically, it does make more sense to fund the UN appeals and other appeals so that we can keep protecting and assisting people in place, and also so that someday when the war in Syria is over, these individuals will be able to go back and rebuild their country.
And since, Jenna Mason, since you represent the UNHCR interests with the U.S. government, particularly the State Department and the Congress, what's the sense of that argument? How receptive is it being? Because if the Europeans are not stepping up to the plate sufficiently in terms of money to deal with the refugee crisis at its borders of Syria, which we've discussed, is there resistance on the part of the U.S. Congress? And how much are we not stepping up to the plate?
Yeah, the U.S. has been the largest donor to UNHCR and other humanitarian agencies. I think the total is around $4 billion that the U.S. has spent on the Syria humanitarian response so far. So definitely, in terms of being a donor, the U.S. is unmatched in terms of its leadership. The U.S. also plays a large diplomatic role along with other countries. Another way to provide protection to a small number but an important segment of the Syrian refugee population is through refugee resettlement. This is an organized legal process where governments interview some Syrians in countries in the region and then admit them to their countries. Resettlement differs from asylum in that people apply from Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, from those countries, as opposed to on their own trying to get to another territory and then apply for asylum. Globally, only about 100,000 refugees from all over the world are resettled in any given year. So it's really a very small solution. But it's important because we use resettlement for people who are particularly vulnerable in those host communities, like people who have been tortured, people with severe medical needs, say women-headed households with large numbers of children that can't survive where they are, high-profile political people, in some cases people with close family members in other countries. So the U.S. is the largest refugee resettlement country as well. European countries don't traditionally do much in the way of refugee resettlement. They, however, receive a lot of asylum seekers, spontaneous asylum seekers, because of their geography. So, again, it doesn't have to be a crisis if a holistic approach is applied. If the governments in the region, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, are provided not just humanitarian funding, but development aid, so that their communities can feel that they're not shouldering the burden of refugees. If the World Bank and international financial institutions are able to provide funding to help these host communities so that they can benefit as well as the Syrian refugees, that's a big part of the response, humanitarian aid and development aid. If the refugee resettlement numbers, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, Australia, Canada, the Nordic countries, the traditional resettlement countries, if they can increase their quotas a little bit for resettlement, that will help. If Europe and other asylum countries can share the burden and be more generous in terms of granting asylum, and then if other countries diplomatically can come together and try to solve the crisis in Syria itself, again, this is a multi-pronged approach, and it won't have to be viewed as a crisis for any one country or any one region of the world.
Well, in this UN report that just came out today on the crisis in Syria, we know that it started out as a spontaneous call for freedom and democracy and rights by the Syrian people in the Arab Spring, just after the dictator Gaddafi had fallen in Libya. And the response of the government of Syria was not to listen to its own people, but to gun them down. And the UN has been blocked at the Security Council level of forcing some kind of a deal or a diplomatic settlement because of vetoes from China and Russia. And this report does, just quoting it again, I think more or less indicate that. The competition amongst regional powers for influence has resulted, among other consequences, in an alarming exacerbation of the sectarian dimensions instigated by the intervention of foreign fighters and extremist clerics. So the situation has clearly gone from bad to worse to basically hideous at this moment. So what, in terms of the UNHCR and the refugee issue that we've been talking about, has China, Russia, or Iran ponied up any money? Because they're, in many ways, along with the Islamic State and those who fund it in the Gulf and in Saudi Arabia, they're a part of the problem, not a part of the solution.
Yeah, many donors to UNHCR give what we call unearmarked or highly earmarked funding. So it's not necessarily designated for the Syria situation, but it is given to UNHCR, and we use a lot of unearmarked money for regions of the world where we feel we need it the most. So some of the countries that you just mentioned and others have given funding that we're able to use for the Syria situation. Like I said, various governments contribute in different ways. Some of them do it through funding. Some of them do it through diplomatic efforts. Some of them, to be honest, haven't quite ponied up, to use your terminology, the way that we might hope, but diplomatically they're working behind the scenes to try to address the crisis. Obviously, you mentioned some countries that have a vested interest in supporting one party or another to the conflict. We would only urge those countries to try to come together, work through the Security Council, work through the existing mechanisms to try to bring about a negotiated solution to this crisis. Because without that, the situation for Syria's neighbors is not going to get any better. What we're seeing in terms of people fleeing across borders and across the Mediterranean is going to increase as the pressure continues to mount in the region. And this could very well then turn into a greater humanitarian crisis affecting more than just the Middle East and Europe. So as a humanitarian agency, we can't offer the solution, but we know that without some sort of peace in Syria, this is going to be what we call a long-term protracted situation.
Well, Jenna Mason, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jenna Mason, who's a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the U.S. government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. We'll take a brief station break, and we'll discuss efforts today in Brussels at an emergency meeting of European leaders to deal with the growing migration crisis.
Head against a pillow fast to sleep. Poor girl, head against a window lost in dream. But one day they will be as giant, stronger than the sun. But that day can't get come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Grisgraber.
Thanks, Ian.
And the whole world has been riveted by this tragic photograph of a Turkish policeman cradling the lifeless body of a three-year-old Kurdish Syrian boy whose body washed ashore. He was drowned along with his five-year-old brother and his mother in a rickety boat, callously set adrift by a smuggler who provided the family with fake life vests. So at this point, apparently, at least this image has affected a number of European leaders who, I think, Angela Merkel has kind of shamed into being more humane in terms of this refugee crisis, particularly the British Prime Minister and the Spanish Prime Minister have agreed to allow more people in, but rather minor quotas. So what's your sense then of the possibility, since the European leaders met in Brussels today, of some kind of coordinated European response to this crisis?
Well, I think it's possible that there will be some progress that we've been pushing for probably about a year now and haven't seen. But it's important to remember that no matter what gets decided, and even if there is a very good regional cooperative response to the Syrian refugee crisis, this is all just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. There are 11 million people displaced from the Syrian conflict, 7.5 million inside, 4 million outside. And so the numbers of people in need are really huge. And those making it to Europe obviously need to be taken care of, need to be supported, and that responsibility needs to be shared. But we also need to keep in mind that there are millions more who are never going to be able to make this journey and who are in just as desperate a situation.
Well, it does seem that it would make more sense for the European countries to help the UNHCR deal with the crisis at its roots there in Syria and in Turkey and in Jordan and Lebanon. 4 million, as you've pointed out, 4 million refugees have already been taken in by these countries, and Turkey spent about $5 billion in humanitarian aid. So why is it that the Europeans are not being particularly cooperative, and particularly the Hungarian Prime Minister has talked about how these refugees from the Middle East threaten Europe's Christian nature and Christian traditions, and he's putting up a razor wire fence and castigating Germany, particularly Angela Merkel, for taking refugees in the first place. So why not, if these people, there's a resistance in Europe, why not help out? Why not pony up some funds to the UNHCR?
Yeah. Well, I think the EU in general, and certainly individual member states as well, have been giving humanitarian aid for the Syrian conflict. So that's both inside Syria and to the refugees. But the fact is that overall, worldwide, there's something of donor fatigue happening in the world right now. Every year in the past probably 5 or 6 years, we have more and more severe crises, and countries don't necessarily have more and more money to be giving to this. So funds are short, and countries are funding, for example, the United Nations agencies where they can for Syria, but the numbers of people in need keep getting bigger, and the amount of money that we're working with is roughly the same or even less. And so I think that's a crucial part of the humanitarian assistance, is to keep helping inside these host countries. But the unfortunate fact is that after almost 5 years of this conflict, there's just not enough aid to go around. And so when the refugees get desperate enough, they look at where they can make a life and where to go next. And in many ways, Europe is the logical choice.
And again, I'm speaking with Darryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Well, it seems, though, that with a right-wing leader in Hungary, Viktor Orban, and there's a number of other right-wing parties in Europe, Western Europe, that are gaining in strength, but Orban is in control of, and he's somewhat authoritarian, he's in control of Hungary, and to his right there's an even more unpleasant right-wing party called Jobbik, who are effectively neo-Nazis, and they've been harassing these refugees crowded at the main train station in Budapest. What happened today was absolutely disgusting. They thought, all these refugees thought they were boarding a train for Austria, when in fact the train only went to a Hungarian refugee reception area, and the people refused to get off, and there are pictures of women on the train tracks wailing and people stuffing children into the trains and all. I mean, you know, when Orban talks about that the refugee or migrant influx threatens Europe's Christian roots, this is not particularly Christian behavior that we're seeing.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I think it's important to probably look below that message at the politics that are there. I mean, right now in the world, it's very easy to get people worked up over a fear of Islam and Muslims, when the fact is it's such a tiny minority of them who have objectionable behavior. But if looking at Europe, you know, for the past 10, 15 years, what's called Fortress Europe has been growing and getting stronger. Fortress Europe being the idea that the borders are getting tighter and it's getting harder and harder for migrants of any type to get into that country. This is a trend that's been going on for over a decade now in Europe. And as more countries fall into economic crisis as well and governments can't provide for their own citizens, unfortunately, it may be natural that people start saying, keep others out. I need my government to take care of me. And I think the religious aspect of the refugees who are arriving right now is just sort of an easy excuse to keep on pushing this idea that people need to be kept out.
So is there anything that can be done? I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, the situation now is almost overwhelming, but it's going to get even more so because there are only of the 11 million displaced Syrians, most of them are still within Syria. 4 million have gotten out, but because Turkey and other countries have absolutely reached the limit, now they are fleeing across the Mediterranean and going through North Africa in these rickety boats, placing their lives in the hands of these callous human traffickers. Is there anything that can be done to take at least the criminal element out of it? You know, the idea that, you know, 71 bodies showed up in a refrigerated truck in Austria, I think, grabbed everybody's attention, but it seems like they're only arresting small fry. Is there any concerted effort to at least not place these people's lives in danger?
Well, I think there's sort of a series of responses to that. I mean, the first and best solution, of course, would be to resolve the conflict in Syria and just obviate the need for people to leave. That's probably not going to happen anytime soon. So far, these efforts have not been successful. So the next best thing would be to make it possible for people to carry on decent, meaningful lives in the countries they first flee to, which are mostly the countries neighboring Syria. Now, it's not to say that those countries, for any reason, should be responsible for taking in most of these refugees. The world needs to share that responsibility. However, because most Syrians I've spoken to, even up until last week, really want to go back to Syria, it makes sense to keep them in a region where it's going to be a bit easier to get back when that time comes. And excluding Turkey, people are often in countries where they speak the language and the culture is somewhat familiar. So if we can make it, if we can give support to these countries and make it possible for refugees to feel like they have a meaningful life in a future where they are right now, that would go a long way toward people, for example, being smuggled on ships across the Mediterranean. Now, nonetheless, that's been happening, and I'm sorry to say it will probably keep happening. And so the next step sort of out from that ideal solution of resolving the conflict is make sure that in Europe, the governments there are equipped to receive refugees, to make sure they have full access to their human rights, and to make sure, again, that they have a chance at a decent life. Otherwise, the fact is they will continue to move on, and who knows what sort of worse tragedies will happen as people get more and more desperate.
So given that the U.S. apparently is the biggest donor so far to the UNHCR's efforts in the neighborhood, as you mentioned, Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon, and the Europeans have, to some extent, ponied up. Has Russia and China, the people who blocked any diplomatic efforts at the UN to resolve this crisis, along with Iran, are they ponying up? And are the Saudis, who are pouring money in, at least either officially or unofficially, into the Islamic State and the other jihadi groups, are they ponying up? What's your sense of who's stepping up to the plate here?
Yeah, that's an important question. Russia has been giving some what we would probably call minimal humanitarian aid for Syria. And the Gulf countries are sort of a mixed bag. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, certainly the UAE to some degree, really have been giving humanitarian aid as well as financial assistance for the Syrian crisis writ large. But part of the question here is, where is that aid going? It's often not being funneled through the United Nations agencies, which in concept is okay, but when it doesn't go through those groups, it's also, the aid is not being coordinated with what those groups and their partners are doing. So there has been, for example, some duplication of cash assistance, and so we could be reaching a lot more people with the basics if the aid coming from the Gulf was coordinated with the larger international system. That said, there's also a push that's been going on for a couple of years for the Gulf countries to start accepting resettled Syrians. It doesn't have to be, I suppose, a formal resettlement program, but some sort of humanitarian admissions even. The idea being, of course, that people who need to be relocated out of the region for their own protection could go to some of the Gulf countries. So far, there have been very, very few entries of Syrians into the Gulf, and there has been a push from the UN, from humanitarian groups, and from various governments around the world to get the Gulf countries to accept more refugees as well. Now, so far, there hasn't been a lot of progress made, but it really is an important aspect of protection of Syrian refugees, because the Gulf countries in general do have a lot of resources where they could make this happen for quite a lot of people.
Well, even though the U.S. is making, I think, the most contributions to the UNHCR, you still have to ask yourself about, you know, the humanitarian aid versus the military expense of the war against the Islamic State. For example, there was recently an Islamic State courier on a motorcycle in, I think it was in Iraq, who was zapped by a U.S. F-18 plane that fired a JDAM, a guided bomb, which cost $675,000. So that you kill one Daesh Islamic State fighter for $675,000, it would seem to me that on the scale of things, that is a little bit disproportionate. You know, obviously, this is not a guns and butter argument here, but nevertheless, it does raise questions, at least in my mind.
Agreed. Disproportionate is exactly the right word. But the fact of the matter is right now, the U.S., and not just the U.S., but in fact a lot of the Western countries and around the world more generally, are probably not going to let go of this idea of a national security imperative anytime soon. Daesh is a problem for practically the whole world, and there's quite a commitment now to combating them. And so it's not realistic probably to expect that aspect of activity or foreign policy or aid is going to be let go anytime soon. So it would be great to have more balance between what's given as humanitarian aid and what goes to other places. And that's something that we can all push for, certainly, and that humanitarian groups, again, are working on. But the fact is, countering extremism has really kind of captured the minds of many of the donor governments and the Western governments, and unfortunately that has been really a priority for them over humanitarian aid most of the time.
So at this point, it seems that Greece, of course, is, and to some extent Italy, is getting the influx from North Africa, and Greece mostly from Turkey, and we know that the Greek economy is in bad shape. The destination seems to be for most of these refugees is to go to Germany or Sweden, where they're certainly more welcome, given the response of Hungary building this 108-mile razor wire fence along the border with Serbia indicates a hardening in the east. And that's what I understand was pretty evident at Brussels today in this meeting of the European leaders. There's a concern now inside Europe that the 28-nation European Union could splinter and that the Western European countries and the Eastern European countries could, you know, become further and further at odds with each other. Is that something that you're detecting?
I haven't thought about it exactly to that end, but what I will say is that if that becomes the case, that'll be really unfortunate because most of the refugees are entering from Eastern Europe. And if we get to a point where there's an east-west split, the fact is that most of the refugees will be stuck on the eastern side. And those tend to be the countries that are not as economically developed and are having a harder time right now. And so that would really be a shame because it would be cutting off yet another avenue of protection for the refugees because Western European countries might be more able to receive them, to support them, to give assistance. So it would be too bad if everyone were, again, stranded at the next point where they landed and unable to get proper assistance.
But that in itself doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? If you're inhospitable to refugees, why would you want to strand them in your country, which is what the Hungarians are doing?
Yeah, fair enough. I would assume that there has been a lack of funding for the Eastern European countries to do a better job at receiving and processing refugees. And there are probably politics involved as well with the Western countries not wanting refugees to keep moving in that direction. But I don't know details of that, unfortunately.
But surely something's going to have to be worked out soon. If as you say, this is just the beginning of a huge outflow from the Middle East, this is not going to slacken off. This is going to increase.
No, absolutely. And I think what needs to happen is, you know, what they're moving toward today in Brussels is some sort of cooperative agreement about which countries can take how many refugees and can offer meaningful assistance and protection to them. And in the meantime, at the same time, we need to keep supporting the regional countries that are hosting the bulk of these refugees so that they don't feel the need to keep making a journey like the one across the Mediterranean where people are dying.
Well, Daryl Grisgraber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the sentencing today of a county clerk in Kentucky who was acting on God's authority.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carl Tobias, who's the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond. He writes with particular emphasis on federal judicial selection and is the author of over 120 law review articles and is the author and co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews. And he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Tobias.
Thank you.
And is there a possibility now that the Rowan County clerk, Kim Davis, who was sentenced today to prison for defying the Supreme Court and claiming she's acting on God's authority to continue to refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, is this likely, instead of fining her, in other words, jailing her, is that likely to turn her into a Christian martyr who will be soon appearing at a mega church near you?
Well, there's some concern. The plaintiffs actually asked the judge not to send her to jail, but rather to fine her and impose penalties by way of civil sanctions, monetary penalties, rather than do that, because I think they were concerned about just that issue. But the judge, Judge Bunning, said no, he would send her to jail. I think because he felt very strongly that you can't have people ignoring or defying federal court orders.
So why do you think Judge Bunning, who is the son of a former Republican senator from Kentucky, appointed by George W. Bush to the bench, certainly has pretty good conservative credentials. Why do you think he did this instead of fining her?
Well, he made a couple of comments along those lines in court, just saying it was a slippery slope and basically people cannot pick and choose what court orders they're going to comply with or not. So I think he's principally protecting the court system as it operates. And I think most federal judges, regardless of their political views, would feel the same way. You just have to have compliance with federal court orders or the system doesn't work. And so I think that was his concern in this particular situation.
So had he fined her, would that, I presume that at some point or other, the county authorities, whoever her superiors are, would have basically said, enough already, we can't go broke because of your religious convictions?
Well, that's a nice question, and I think there's not a clear answer to it, who might have been responsible for those kinds of fines, whether she would have been responsible personally or the state or the locality, and that, I don't think, was clearly resolved. And maybe that was part of the judge's decision as well. But she doesn't seem inclined to comply with any order that she feels forces her to issue these licenses.
So in terms of the theatrics surrounding it, with demonstrators on both sides of the issues, both in the county clerk's room, where we've seen video of same-sex couples, basically saying, you know, on whose authority you're doing this, denying us marriage license, and she said, on God's authority. We've seen that. But there's also been people gathered outside. Many of them are supporting this county clerk, Kim Davis. So this does seem to be a case between the difference between faith and facts. You know, how can you persuade people that think that she's acting in God's name and they believe in the word of God, that in fact it's somewhat misplaced, that, nobody's impinging on her First Amendment rights as an individual, but she's not an individual in this case. She's a servant of the public.
Well, that's correct. She is a public official, and I think the judge was reflecting that, too, in his decision. And so we'll see where it goes from here. But I do think there are strong feelings on this issue among many people. But I think the plaintiffs felt that they had been vindicated by the Supreme Court and that they were entitled to exercise their rights to have a marriage license. And so there's just a conflict there that really can't be resolved. But apparently the deputy clerks, five of the six, I think, are told the judge today they would issue the licenses starting Friday. So that may help resolve some of the controversy.
So, in other words, if the other clerks in the office start issuing licenses, does that get Kim Davis off the hook and get her out of prison, even though she would perhaps continue to refuse to do them? I mean, at some point or other, is she required to relent?
I don't know. Hopefully, yes, at least from the judge's perspective and the court system perspective. But at least in the short term, people who want licenses will be able to secure them from the deputy clerks. But I think I saw that she actually had ordered the deputy clerks to not issue the licenses. But I don't know how she can stop them once she's in jail and they're in the office tomorrow. So I believe there will be licenses issued. But I think she will remain in jail until she accedes to the judge's court order.
And again, I'm speaking with Carl Tobias, who's a chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond. He writes with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selections, and he's the author of 120 law review articles and the author or co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews. And he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. So how does this, as a law professor, relate to the broader issues, given that the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage and this county clerk is defying the Supreme Court? It went up the chain. It actually went through Judge Benning's court and all the way to the Supreme Court. And basically, she's been told that she doesn't have a leg to stand on, but isn't claiming, I guess, a higher authority from God. But in the Supreme Court decision to legalize same-sex marriage across the country, there was a pretty vocal dissent from Chief Justice Roberts. And it's in many interpreted his dissent as opening the door in terms, or the back door, if you will, in terms of this idea of religious freedom that we've seen. We saw it erupted in Indiana with the governor trying to put it into law, and there was a backlash to him. But in general, the Supreme Court did pass this Hobby Lobby decision, which could be built upon if this movement takes up any steam. So is the religious freedom laws a sort of second bite at the apple for those who feel they lost out on the gay marriage argument?
Well, it's possible. I don't know that we've seen the end of it. I think that's correct. But I think maybe one takeaway from what's happened is that hopefully we'll see less of the kind of recalcitrance, if you will, from people like Kim Davis, and hopefully, and you know, across at least where I live in Virginia, and across much of the even the South, I think most all clerks are complying. There are very few exceptions. But I think my concern, and that of Judge Bunning and probably many federal judges, is just the rule of law. The Supreme Court has spoken, and it made clear, even though there wasn't much of an opinion, that Davis wasn't entitled to a stay. And so I think that's pretty much where we are now. But there certainly could be some efforts to try to balance out the rights of people who are concerned about their religious freedom. And we have statutes on the books that do that. But I don't think it's going to overcome the Supreme Court's decision in June from what we've seen so far. But we may see situations like Indiana and other situations where there may be some statutes at the state level that would try to expand religious freedoms. And there also may be ways, and I think there were ways in Kentucky around this problem of the clerk, but those avenues weren't finally used. And so, to some extent, I think Kim Davis became an example in terms of her treatment, and I think people could differ about whether that was a good idea or not. But, you know, I guess I come at it from a systemic perspective in the court system, and the merits of this dispute have been resolved. So we'll see. I mean, there could be a constitutional amendment or something of that sort, and there could be amendments to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the federal level and the state level. But I still don't know that they are going to protect someone in her situation.
But it obviously, judged by what some of the people outside the court was saying today in support of the county clerk who's been sent to jail, quoting Danny Kinder, a 73-year-old retiree from Moorhead, Kentucky, he said they've overstepped their bounds. They're taking rights away from Christians. And again, that sort of feeds into the martyrdom narrative. And that is a fairly popular narrative, I think, amongst Christian evangelicals. Is, after all, the prophet himself, Jesus, was martyred. And I recall that, for example, the popular right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh's brother wrote a whole book that was based upon the premise that Christians in the United States are persecuted. As somebody who's who has you know, followed certainly this same-sex marriage issue, and I imagine living in Virginia, you're pretty familiar with Christian beliefs and in terms of how they're practiced in fundamentalist and evangelical churches. Is that, I think, a fair assessment, that there is a sort of an exaggerated martyrdom complex? Because I don't believe there are any other countries in the world that's as quite as hospitable to religion as the United States is.
Well, that's a good question. But I do I think there are strong feelings among some people in certain parts of the country, and maybe in every state to some extent, and we saw those expressed. But there were equally strong views expressed on the other side, I think, today by people who came to the courthouse or went to the clerk's office. So that's a big part of what America's all about, is trying to reconcile conflicting interests. And so I think the judge did what he felt was his duty in this particular situation, and we'll have to see in the future.
Well, it does seem to be sort of getting into the opening up this perennial can of worms known as the culture wars. would you agree with that?
Well, I think that could be. And we have, you know, presidential election coming up in next year, and so
haven't you noticed it's already happening?
Yes, and so I hope that this will not play back on that, but it could.
Right. Well, I must say that just in terms of culture wars, you know, I think that in many ways, Christian families, particularly those that are concerned about their what influences their children, you know, if you watched those MTV awards the other night with Miley Cyrus and that fellow that President Obama referred to as a jackass, Kanye West, announcing he's running for president, the whole spectacle was so sort of in your face, you know, let's smoke dope. Let's, you know, wear virtually no clothes. You know, there is a culture war going on in this country, and in many ways, I'm not entirely sympathetic to those who are pushing, you know, the sort of libertine angle as opposed to the... in other words, we're sort of in a polarized universe of a choice between piety and porn.
Well, I guess that's true, at least on either end of the spectrum. But I think, you know, the balance of people in the country are somewhere in the middle, and so hopefully don't see this as polarized. But I, you know, I come back to the fact that the Supreme Court's ruled and that found in the 14th Amendment that bans were unconstitutional, violated equal protection and due process, and so. We have to find ways to then implement that mandate from the Supreme Court.
So it comes down to living with the law of the land then?
I think so. I think so. And I think the relevant precedents to some extent are those that were applicable during the time of public school desegregation. And the major case is Cooper versus Aaron in 1958, where the Supreme Court said you can't war against the Constitution. And so I think that case and those ideas are important ones to the society, even as I recognize there are certainly strong religious freedom issues involved here. And You have to address that.
Well, Carl Tobias, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Carl Tobias, his chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond. He writes with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection and is the author of over 120 law review articles and the author or co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews. And he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.